This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of New Books Network. This is your host, Morteza Hajizadeh. And today, I'm very excited to be speaking about a sort of a hidden treasure, an unknown treasure, a book called The Merits of the Plague, written by Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. I hope I'm pronouncing the name correctly, but if I'm not, there I've got two experts to pronounce to correct me. So with me to discuss this book, I've got the translators, Mehraj Sayed, who is Associate Professor of Religious Studies and Director of Medieval and Early Modern Studies Program at UC Davis University, and also Joel Blecker, who is an Associate Professor of Islamic History at George Washington University. Mehraj and Joel, welcome to New Books Network.
Thank you for having us.
I think before we started recording this interview, I was telling you how excited I was to find out about this book. So as you and our listeners are aware, in 2020, after the pandemic, there was this this demand, or let's say this craze for books written about pandemics, about disease. And most of the time people would go to those classics like the Decameron. But there have been works, great works of literature also written in the East. One of them is Merits of the Plague, which you have translated. So before talking about the book, can you briefly introduce yourself, talk about your field of expertise? And I'm really, really keen to know how you learned Arabic. I don't think it was an easy job to translate this book. So maybe we should start with you, Mehraj.
Yeah, so I am a professor of religious studies and Middle East South Asia studies here at University of California, Davis. My field of research and specialty is Islamic intellectual history, Islamic ethics, Islamic law. And right now I'm doing a lot of research in computational or digital humanities approaches to understanding Islamic texts, Arabic Islamic texts, especially the Hadith literature. How did I learn Arabic? That was like the final question, right? I feel like you never really stop learning Arabic. So I think, you know, it's one of these languages. I think that the CIA has labeled it as one of the most difficult languages in the world, along with Chinese. I feel like that is true. My Arabic, learning kind of started very young, in the sense that I come from a religious Muslim family, and it doesn't matter whether you're Arab or not, you have to learn how to read the Quran, which means at a minimum, you have to learn how to phonetically, read the script. You might not even understand what's going on. So, that started when I was like a very young child, 6, 7, 8 years old. I was part of a very active Muslim community in Texas. I grew up in Texas, and we happened to have the great fortune of having a Turkish imam who was actually quite learned. He had studied Islam according to the old Ottoman curriculum. So all of the old style way of learning language and tafsir and fiqh and kalam and all of that. He was quite knowledgeable. He was an alim, but he also did a PhD in secular Turkish universities. So he was learned, and one of the classes that he taught routinely was Quranic Arabic. So by the time I had graduated from high school, I had a basic understanding of some vocabulary, basic understanding of Arabic grammar. Then I went and I took 2 years of Arabic at my college, University of Texas at Austin. And then graduate, I took more Arabic in my master's program at UCLA, and I took some text reading classes at Princeton, where I did my PhD, and have been studying the language in its various ways, and which is where I met my colleague and very good friend, Joel Blecker. Distinguished gentleman is what I like to, how I like to call him, because he truly is a distinguished gentleman. And that's my a little bit about my journey with Arabic language.
Great, thank
yeah,
you.
And me, but... Joel.
Yes, sure. Well, I yeah, I'm currently in Berlin, actually. I Mortaz, you neglected to tell our audience that this is a truly international podcast,
yes,
and
that's
that
right.
Mortaz is based in Australia, Mehraj is based in California, and I am phoning in from Berlin, Germany right now. So we've got all three corners of the earth at least. Right now I'm a fellow at the Wissenschaftskolleg, and I'm researching a book on Islam and the spice trade, which involves one of the characters of the book is Ibn Hajar, who we're discussing tonight. When I'm in the United States, I'm a professor of history at the George Washington University, and I teach Islamic history. My journey studying Arabic, I guess, probably reaches back to the dark days of the war on terror in the early 2000s. I remember, man, I remember I was living outside of Philadelphia at that time, which is also a really interesting place for a lot of different kinds of Arabic speaking communities. Basically, I just remember, I mean, I remember that was a time, I mean, it was a time of great ignorance, of course, in the public discourse after 2001. But there was also a lot of catching up that academics needed to do. Even in the academy, there were, for instance, at my little college, there was no Arabic program. I think this was a predicament that many colleges and universities across the United States were struggling with. So I remember it was actually after college that I went and traveled to Syria with the idea of trying to teach myself Arabic, to learn Arabic. I studied Arabic at the University of Damascus. They had a little language center there. And it was, it was a really interesting time, an amazing time to be living in Syria, to be studying Arabic. And I was really interested, even back then, in translation projects. I think one of my first jobs, to kind of keep myself afloat in Syria, was, of course, it was teaching English, but also translating Arabic. And I remember actually I had a job translating Canadian music television and cooking shows from giving these like classical Arabic subtitles for these really cheesy television shows. And I remember one of them was a cooking show that was going to be broadcast in Syria, that was like, it was about cooking with spirits. So there was one terrible episode where the chef was going to cook like ham and whiskey, which is like basically two harams, and we had to translate it as meat cooked in beverage try to appease the censors. But if anyone was around in those days in the 2000s and you wondered why were those classical Arabic subtitles so terrible, it's because they had hired people like me to translate them. And then I applied to graduate school from an internet cafe in Damascus, and I was really lucky to get in to Princeton, which is where I met my distinguished brother, Mehraj Syed. And so many years later, we collaborated to produce this book.
Thank you very much for this thorough introduction. I actually identified with two stories based on you. Well, with Miraj, I'm from Iran myself, so I think I don't speak Arabic, but in one time, but in sometimes we're lucky because we share the same alphabet, and there are a lot of Arabic words in Persian. So when I was in school, I had to read Quran as well as a part of my religious studies course. And I just read it without the correct pronunciation, Arabic pronunciation. I didn't know what it meant. We just read it. I could pick up a few words and here and there, but unfortunately, Arabic in the schools in Iran are not really taught well. It's highly grammatical. They focus a lot on grammar rather than the dialect, and people come to be put off by Arabic. I think I did fail one of my Arabic courses, which was a shock to me, given I was a very good student. But anyway, and speaking of Arabic translations, translation of English text into Arabic or even in Farsi, there was a story in Iran when you translate the book from English to Farsi, you need to take it to the Ministry of Culture to check everything and make sure everything is okay. So the word for whiskey is, well, they try to change it into tea, but we use one word which in Farsi, which is Arabic, I guess, called araq, which means beverages, alcoholic beverages in general. But the funny thing is that araq also in Farsi means sweat. So it has two meanings. So the guy, I think the guy who had the manuscript just did Control F, changed the word beverage, which was Arab, with sweat. Sorry, with tea all throughout the dialogue, with tea. And he didn't notice that in one case, the word Arab actually meant sweat. So it was the text read like this when it was published, that the guy was tired. He lied down on the couch and wiped off the whiskey off his forehead. Didn't make any sense because, yeah. Anyhow, let's talk about this book and also the plague. The book is called The Merits of the Plague, and it's written by Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani. But can you tell us a little bit about the plague in the Islamic world? The plague that this book discusses happened in the 15th century. Tell us about the plague in and the Islamic history more broadly. Just to set the background to talk about the book.
I can start. This book is it's a it was, as Morteza said, is written in it was written in the 15th century, but it's also rep and it was responding to live events that were unfolding within Cairo, these kind of wave after successive wave of plague that followed the Black Death. But in a certain sense, what the book does is that it draws on a very, very long tradition of discourses about the plague in Islamic thought. It to try to address what's going on, what was going on in the author's own life. And so the book both has a very interesting argument, it crafts a very interesting argument, but it's also in a certain sense can serve as an anthology of many, many layers of Islamic thought, Islamic discourse on the plague, going back to in a certain sense the lifetime of the prophet. Even though he himself didn't live through a bubonic plague, he thought about disease and pestilence and epidemics. According to the chronology that Ibn Hajar creates, he had, you know, he in his own lifetime there had been some instances of some diseases that were being described as a plague in Iran and Central Asia, I think during the prophet's lifetime. So, you know, one of the interesting questions that some of the early scholars of plague in Islamic history raised is, what was the role of plague and disease in weakening, for instance, the Byzantine Empire at the time of the rise of Islam and the early Islamic history? Did, for instance, is plague part of the reason that's that kind of allowed for the kind of the political collapse of the Byzantines, or the weakening of the Byzantines during that time. Did plague, for instance, also play a role in the weakening of the Umayyads and allowing the Abbasids to push westward? So, I think when we before the pandemic, when we used to think about a lot of these narratives of early Islamic history, of course we always thought about plague, but I think watching what happened during the COVID-19 pandemic and really living through that this experience and seeing, wow, okay, these pandemics can really reshape economies and politics. It's certainly and certainly the experience of translating this book stimulated that discussion between Miraj and I is what was the power of these kinds of diseases in not only shaping this period of history that Ibn Hajar lived through, but did it also have the power to shape the politics and society of in which Islam emerged?
Thank you, Joel. One thing I'm interested in, and I think we saw parallels in 2020 as well with COVID, is that was that a lot of people they were just encountered with this unknown threat, COVID, and scientists were trying to figure out how to find a vaccine. And a lot of people tried to seek solace in literature or even in religious sources as well. So I'm curious to know that in the 15th century Egypt, what was the role of religion in responding to this? Did people become more interested in finding consolation and peace in through religious literature or words of prophet, let's say?
I think that there's generally speaking, the Quran and the Hadith themselves as well, probably speak to some of the humanity's most existential needs. Like how do you handle things that are absolutely outside of your control, that happen to you? Bad things and good things, but especially bad things. What is the proper theological and religious and ethical response to tragedy, to calamity? And calamity and tragedy that may not just affect you personally, but your entire society, like something like a plague that ends up killing tens of thousands of people, maybe millions even globally, so religion, Islam in general, religion as well, has a lot of things to say about these existential questions. The Hadith kind of counsel Muslims to what is the proper response to disease? What is the proper response to calamity, generally speaking? And then, because the early Muslims, like what Joel was saying previously, had experience with plague, the Justinian plague in the 7th and 8th centuries, the traces of that experience are found in the Hadith literature. So we actually have many Hadith that directly address plagues. And many of these hadiths, talk about, what is the meaning of the plague? Well, the plague is a punishment, but it can also be a source of mercy, and it has the potential of conferring the status, which is a very high status in Islam, which of a martyr. Someone who dies of the plague with the right attitude dies a martyr. And there are hadith that also say that provide more practical guidance. Like the prophet says something like, "Well, if you hear of a plague striking a city, don't go to that city. And if you're in the city when the plague strikes, don't leave it." So there's some basic notion of quarantine at play as well. And there are other hadith that say that you should seek refuge in God from disease, generally speaking, and that God is the ultimate source of protection and solace. There are many hadiths that touch upon different aspects of experience with disease and experience with the plague specifically. And those are some of those. And because Ibn Hajar is, one of his, probably his claim to fame, actually, to be honest with you, his claim to fame is as a hadith scholar. He is a monumental scholar of hadith in the Sunni tradition, even to this day. And his most important work, Fath al-Bari, is a commentary on the most authoritative collection of hadiths in Sunni Islam, Sahih al-Bukhari. So, and so because that's his claim to fame, that's what he was a specialist in. The merits of the plague is essentially, in many ways, an encyclopedic catalog of different hadiths on plague and disease, and commentary and scholarly engagement with those hadiths as well. So, it's a little bit of long-winded answer. Joel, I don't know if you want to add anything or I left anything out.
Well, no, I think it's great. I mean, it was such a rich overview, and this is such a rich book because it brings together not just hadith, but it weaves medical literature, Greek influence, medical literature. It weaves together, as Mehraj was talking about, legal commentary, theological commentary on hadith, it also, as Mehraj was saying, Ibn Hajar is one of the most important. I mean, he maybe he's the, I mean, the kind of paragon of Hadith scholarship in the Sunni tradition. But he was also a well-known historian, and actually a pretty distinguished poet as well. You'll find scholars of Arabic literature who analyze his poetry. It's not like the kind of mediocre, run-of-the-mill scholarly poetry that you sometimes find. So to that end too, he brings in poetry into the book. He weaves in history into the book and his knowledge of history. And on top of all of that, he was also a sitting judge. So he really thinks about these issues not just from an academic standpoint, but he really thinks about how they affect real people. And what's nice about this book, this genre, is that it's not his magnum opus. It's not Fath al-Bari, as Mehraj described, this kind of multi-volume book that he spent 30 years of his life working on. He actually borrowed some material from that text to put in this book. But this book really was meant to try to address a broader audience and a general audience for his own time. So that's, I think, what was so appealing to this project was so appealing for Mehraj and I to take on during the pandemic was, and why we tried to why we brought it to Penguin to publish rather than a more or bringing it to say like a university press or a scholarly a kind of a more a press that's just dedicated to publishing scholarly translations was because we thought, this is probably Penguin. If Ibn Hajar could publish his book in his own time, if there was a kind of analogy to Penguin, maybe he would publish it with a press like that.
And I think that was a fantastic decision. At least it's in the libraries and a lot of people can pick it up and read it rather than being only stored away in a university library. Both of you touched upon, Ibn Hajar's aspects of life. He's and thank you, Joe, for mentioning about the richness of the book, because when I was going through the book, I thought, okay, what is this? It's there are religious elements in the book, history, poetry, even philosophy. It's a very rich text in that sense. So can you just briefly introduce Ibn Hajar to us? You have mentioned that he was a judge and was also a lecturer. And I'm also interested to know more about how plague specifically affected him personally. He lost some of his children to plague. And also, is that why what triggered him to write the book?
Well, I mean, Ibn Hajar is a really fascinating character, and In a certain sense, I told you I'm working on him right now for my book on the spice trade, because he, in addition to all of those other hats that he wore that I just described, he was also a very prosperous merchant who worked the Red Sea route when he was younger. And then he was more of a sedentary merchant later in life, where he would invest in other trading adventures down the coast of the Red Sea to Yemen. And so he's a very interesting person. I had been studying him as I had been working on this other project when the COVID-19 pandemic hit in the March of 2020. And I remember, Mehraj and I had been talking about working on a translation for a very long time. And I remember, it occurred to me, I was coming home, from work one day, and it occurred to me, Ibn Hajar actually has this very important book on the plague. And of course, diving deeper into it, we found that he had been personally affected by it. He had lost three children to the plague. One of his daughters that he lost, his oldest daughter, he was very close with, and she died apparently while she was expecting one of his grandchildren. So it's a really heartbreaking story. You have to imagine it would have affected him in a really personal way. And of course, he's seeing his whole world fall apart, right? The economy is being turned upside down. He's seeing the inflation in the streets. He's seeing, he describes in his histories, he describes this one really vivid moment where he sees basically the caskets, the line of caskets is so long that it looks like one of these like camels tied by the tail, where they're just, a long string of camels tied by the tail with one another. He describes these just very, very dark episodes that he lived through, where he remembers crocodiles floating belly up in the Nile. He remembers gazelles and wolves kind of strewn about the countryside in the same way. So it's pretty it's pretty amazing to hear someone who had both kind of saw the way in which the plague affected his society, saw the way that it affected his own family, and kind of had to deal with that loss. And then at the same time, in a certain sense, he almost compartmentalizes it and kind of turns on a certain kind of intellectual mind, a reasoning mind, this kind of the mind of a hadith scholar, and he just trains it with laser focus on this textual tradition. And and so the book, in a certain way, as much as it is trying to speak to a general audience, it actually ends up being a very deep and intellectual reflection on not just what he thinks is the proper way of understanding the plague, but also in a certain sense, giving you a snapshot of the range of debates, the range of disputes about the plague. And so in that sense, it's this book also is in a certain sense like it kind of crystallizes in amber all of those disagreements and disputes that inevitably emerge when you have a pandemic. And so, what Mehraj and I noticed right away when we were looking through this text, that a lot of the same disagreements and debates that we were living through in 2020, 2021, over social distancing, over quarantines, over the origin of the disease. Was it in a lab? Was it from an animal market or an open air market? lot of those same debates and disagreements that were causing so much, or were generating so much controversy, we saw a lot of those same debates being reflected in the pages of Ibn Hajar's texts as well. So the question over the origin, what is the origin of the plague? This is a huge matter of disagreement. Was it a miasma in the air? Was it something that's transmitted by contagion? That's one of the big debates, and it has quite a big that has quite a large bearing on the question of whether you can distance, whether you should distance. And of course, maybe just to put a underline a point on it, to take it back to the kinds of issues in Islamic ethics that Miraj brought up earlier, if you want to care for someone, right, you want to give them care, you want to console them, and you have this kind of ethical obligation not to abandon someone who's sick, right? This is, this question of whether you should flee, or whether it's incumbent on you to flee or run from the plague, whether it's futile to do so, whether the plague will be transmitted to you if you mix with someone, all of that has huge bearing on these questions of social distancing.
Let's talk about the argument of the book, and also what was this collaboration to translate the book like? So I would appreciate if you could talk about why and when you decided to translate the book, how it went about, what was the, and then also the argument of the book. How does Ibn Hajar think of plague? Is it God's will? Is it the punishment from God? Is it a time or opportunity to practice patience and care? So I'll leave it to you to discuss how you collaborated about the translation and also some of the themes of the book about the plague.
I mean the collaboration was really inspired by COVID, the experience of living through COVID and lockdown. We had, Joel and I had, we went to grad school together. We were both at Princeton. We had considerable amount of overlap. We pretty much, went through the program together. And we became good friends and we kept in touch. And we had always, had this idea that, hey, we're good friends, let's collaborate on a project, whatever that project could be. We don't know, but we should do something. And Joel, had this brilliant idea, very brilliant idea, that why don't there's this one, very, very important text in the Islamic tradition on the plague, written by this momentous figure, Ibn Hajar, that has not been translated into English. Let's translate it, and let's pitch it to Penguin and see if we can't get a book contract. And we will, by collaborating, working on it together, hopefully the process will be a lot faster. And that ended up being very true. It took us about 3 years to translate the book and write the introduction and go through all of the stages of publication. I mean, if I was to work on this work by myself, I don't think I would have finished it in 6 years, maybe even longer. And I think that so it wasn't just I say the collaboration wasn't just a matter of like, oh, we take a project that is X and then we divide it into two, like the number of collaborators. That is true. I mean, that definitely, happened, but I think it also just became a lot more enjoyable because we were doing a project together. It's a fun project. We were both exploring how do you translate this? What is Ibn Hajar trying to get at? We're having difficulty. We were also commiserating about the process and how slow it was going. We were in competition with each other sometimes. Look, man, I would, text him saying, look, I just translated 10 paragraphs, man. Let's see if you can beat that tomorrow. So we were trash talking. So it was just a very, very, I would say that out of all of the academic and scholarly projects that I've done, this one was the most enjoyable just because, you know, the friendship that me and Joel have kind of just made the entire process very easy. So that's my thoughts on the collaboration.
Yeah, we both had to up our Giphy game, like texting Giphies to each other when we would complete like 1,000 words translating. Yeah,
So yeah, it was
definitely a ditto on that, Miraj. On the argument of the book, this was something that we also discovered just as we were translating it. I mean, Ibn Hajar is a renowned hadith scholar. So what he would do is he would have these very dense citations every time he would quote a hadith, which would include both sometimes it would grade the soundness and reliability of the hadith for the reader. And they were just, I think if he had published the book today, his editor would have said, "Oh, just put that in a footnote or an endnote, or you can just put that in an appendix, because that's, or maybe just say something short about the grade of the hadith." But of course, in the textual culture that Ibn Hajar was working on, there was no footnote, there was no endnote. And we can see, like, he actually did try to help his readers, by including glosses, for instance, at the end of every chapter. So we saw that he really was trying to make the text accessible to non-specialists. So our idea was actually to just kind of to put all of that citational information, that's the information on the isnads, the chains of transmission, put that in the endnotes. It ended up being something like 80 or 90 pages of endnotes, which our editor, sadly, alas, made us cut out. But we essentially ended up doing to solve that, where we abridged his notes, and then we told specialists where they can find more information in the original Arabic, and we gave general audiences a sense of what Ibn Hajar's own process was with those chains of transmission. But the point I just wanted to make, and maybe I can set Mehraj up for kind of unfolding the argument that he makes, was just that once we took that citational information out, or we put it in the endnotes, in a certain sense, it allowed us to see that he wasn't just collecting an anthology of hadith on the plague from, or just an anthology of, wise sayings about the hadith, be it from a physician or a jurist or a theologian or a poet, but that once we could kind of clear away that critical apparatus, we could actually see this argument unfold, and that he had actually structured this work in a way so that each chapter built on the last, so that in a certain sense there really was a foundation that he laid in the first chapter about the early origins of the plague, and then built on it in the second chapter, where he asks this question: what was the origin of the plague? And then listening, well, here's what the physicians theorized, and then he goes into this theory of miasma and polluted air. And it's at that point that he then turns and he says, well, this polluted air actually doesn't make sense from an empirical standpoint, because when I look around and I see a household in afflicted with plague, some members of the household have it and others don't, and the physicians just can't explain it. They're both breathing the same air. So this problem of contagion and transmission was fundamental to trying to understand and unlock what the what Ibn Hajar's theory to what might be happening. So I try to set you up, Mirage, for the kind of where Ibn Hajar goes from this, from there.
Yeah, I mean his I mean I agree with what Joel just said. When we were first reading through it, because he is a I feel like he's a scholar, and a scholar is someone that is comprehensive in their citation of all the material that could potentially be relevant to the topic at hand. And Ibn Hajar was very, very encyclopedic in his collection of the variety of different things that could potentially be relevant to the plague. And then the scholar is also very careful in his reasoning and argumentation. And sometimes when you are reading it, you would get lost because it's very intricate, very detail oriented, a huge number of sources that in which there are potential contradictions, and the variety of different ways in which those contradictions can be solved. And Ibn Hajar gives, here are five different ways in which the contradiction can be solved, So when you get into it at that level of detail, it's hard to see what is the overall shape of the argument of the book. But I think Joel is right that there is an overall shape and argument to the book. And I think that the overall argument is kind of like the plague, which is catastrophic and traumatic from a human perspective and point of view, undeniably so. But still, it is firmly within the divine will. It is willed by God. God is not, it is, the plague doesn't happen. The plague happens through God's agency, that's undeniable in Islamic theology. And the plague, but the plague, despite it being a calamity from a human perspective, potentially has the opportunity for human redemption by displaying an ethical concern for other people, taking care of them when they get the disease, by being God conscious, by being accepting of God's will and accepting that things happen that are outside of your control, and by displaying the, virtues of forbearance and patience and acceptance of God's command and God's will, and living a pious life in the face of that. And you do that, Ibn Hajar's argument is based on the hadith in the Quran that he analyzes, and you die a martyr's death. And that is the highest and most noble death that a Muslim can hope for. And I think this is really the crux of the issue. And that's the reason why you have this very interesting title, like a plague is fundamentally bad and evil, but there are merits to it. Well, here's how. It's kind of what he says.
And by the way, when I came across the book, I tried to find the original title in Arabic and then use Google Translate, to see what the original title is. Is that a literal translation of the title, Merits of the Plague?
It's the second half of the title, Badl al-Ma'un fi Fadl al-Ta'un. So, expending
It's an
effort.
offering aid on the merits of the plague was how we translated the full title. And of course, actually, there's a few different, even a few different titles floating around in Arabic as well.
That's, I guess, what confused me.
Yes, Buffy Budlet Ta'un, that last part, offering aid on the merits of the plague. We took the last part and said, okay, let's call it merits of
Well, I can pick that up in Farsi as well because we use the same Arabic words. Plague is
the plague.
ta'un, fazl is fazilat or virtue or merit. But in a religious sense, when you say fazl or fazilat, in a religious sense is merit. So that was easy to pick up for me. Do you know when this book, so the book was written in the 15th century. Do you know when it traveled to Europe? When did Europeans discover this book? But it's quite amazing that this book hadn't really been translated into English until a couple of years ago that you did that. But when did Europeans come across this
Yeah, so
book?
I mean, it's interesting. It really when we first see Europeans reading it, it's librarians in like the catalog of the Escorial, who are writing summaries of the book in Latin. There was an interesting Latin, a Latinization of Ibn Hajar's name was Shahabuddinus Ibn Hagar Ascalonensis, which I found, I don't know, I found it funny to think of, you know, Ibn Hajar's name in Latin, in the, you know, in these 17th, 18th century Latin library catalogs. And yeah, I mean, they summarized the book. They were really interested in the way in which the book says not to flee from the plague. And of course, that can be caricatured. You know, this idea is, you know, the plague is striking and you don't run away from it. You don't flee from it. But I mean, the way Mehraj put it, I mean, this that wonderful overview that he just gave, you can see it's, I mean, you can see it's a very complex, very deeply thought, deeply reflected argument. And so, yeah, so you see those kinds of summaries in those library catalogs. But for the most part, it really has, you know, it was not really read in the Latin West in the same way that the Quran was read and translated into Latin, or the way in which, say, Ibn Sina or Avicenna's Canon of Medicine was read and translated first into Hebrew and then into Latin. So, you know, I think it's interesting, you know, to try to bring this book, to try to expand the canon of plague literature to include this book. I think that's another reason why we thought Penguin was, you know, was a really interesting press to try to think about this book, to try to widen what it means to be a classic, because the current canon of plague literature is quite narrowly European. When you think about, right, Camus' big book on the plague, Boccaccio, Camus' book is actually set in North Africa, in a city in North Africa where the libraries probably held texts like Ibn Hajar's Merits of the Plague. And yet there's not a single Muslim character in the book, and not a single mention of this really rich, this very long tradition of Islamic thought about the plague. And I think, you know, in retrospect, you know, when I think about the COVID-19 pandemic, we often think about how flat-footed we were caught. We didn't know enough about these kinds of diseases. We didn't know how they were transmitted. We didn't have enough glass tubes to distribute the vaccine. But I think at an intellectual level, maybe at this broader spiritual level too, as Mehraj is describing, I think we were also impoverished as a society. At least English-speaking readers were impoverished in the sense that the kinds of texts that that English readers had to turn to were from a very narrow, was from a very narrow list. So yeah, we hope that with this book we could try to expand that list just a little bit.
Thanks. And Joel, I know it's 11:20 in Germany now, so I'm just going to ask one short question and then ask you to read your favorite part of these. I'm really enjoying this conversation. I don't want to end it, but I understand that it's kind of late there. So yeah, just one quick question.
I fall asleep mid-question, you know.
One quick question, then I'll ask you to read your favorite passage from the book. The question is that this book is also popular in Arabic, right? So there have been prints of this book in Arabic. So just, I would be great if we could talk about the contemporary reception of this book in Arabic world. And then I'll ask Mehraj and Joel to read your favorite part of the book.
Well, I mean, I noticed that this book was for instance, that, we saw it invoked on the pages of the New York Times, as a, and there was an op-ed by Ibrahim Musa, who cited this work when he was arguing for the suspension of the Hajj during the COVID-19 pandemic. So it's interesting that a book like this can kind of come back into social and political relevance and religious relevance. I saw YouTube videos in Arabic about this book during the COVID-19 pandemic. I have new readings of it. So I do think, it is one of these books that, it's amazing, it's 500 years later that people return to. And in a certain sense, that's the very definition of a classic, right? A book that is written, is very much a product of its own time, but can also reach out and speak across time.
And can I ask you, maybe we'll start with Mehraj, to read your favorite part, a short passage from this book, and tell us the context around it?
Sure. So this is the last page of the translation, which is actually from an appendix that we translated, which we titled Ibn Hajar's Journal of the Plague Years. And this is the last passage, the last paragraph, where Ibn Hajar is talking in the first person about his own experience of being struck by the plague. And I really like it. So I'm just going to read half a page. So this is page 224, the plague of 848, which is the Hijri year. 1444 is the Christian year. Ibn Hajar is struck by the plague. Beginning Monday, the 1st of Muharram, April 20th, the plague began to gradually increase until the debts each day exceeded 120 among those who registered for inheritance. It was said that it exceeded 200 a day, and most of those who died were slaves and children. It continued to gradually increase and intensified its fire-like spread until it penetrated the pilgrimage and increased further, and throngs of the pilgrims' slaves and children died. It was said that the death toll may have reached 1,000 a day. On Friday, Safar III, May 22nd, after the Friday prayers, as the sun's state was that of the third month of the solar year, and the skies rained lightly without thunder, a tempestuous dust storm which then subsided. Then people began to chatter among themselves that the pestilence had abated after its peak. On Sunday night, the 5th of Safar, May 24th, I discovered a pain under my right armpit and a prickly source of discomfort, but went to sleep despite it. The next day, the pain increased slightly, so I went back to sleep in acceptance and full recognition that the affliction remained unchanged. By the 10th, it appeared under my armpit like a soft plum. After that, it lightened little by little until only a final portion of it remained. Then it went away as if it had never been. Praise be to God. That's the
How end. Composed it was, but I would have freaked out.
Well, it ends in such an undramatic dramatic fashion.
Yeah, that's right.
Dramatic in how undramatic it is.
Exactly, right. You can see like the rise and fall in the narrative. And Joel, can I ask you also to read your favorite part of the book?
Sure. So this part is a bit more dramatic because this is in the epilogue of the book. Or in Arabic, we call this the khatam, or the, which is also a, you will know, is from the end. And this is, if he was reciting this book aloud and dictating it aloud to his students, this is the one session where everybody comes. if you had been late or tardy, or you've been missing his lectures, you would all come to the final, to the khatam. You would celebrate the end of the book. you would usually do a poetry reading, and there would usually be food involved as well. So this is one of the more entertaining parts of the book. And this is a poem. It's not written by Ibn Hajar. He's quoting a Syrian scholar whose name was Ibn al-Wardi, who lived through the worst, I mean the worst of the Black Death in the mid 14th century. So this is now, this poem is now about 70 or 80 years old at the time Ibn Hajar is reciting it. And this poem actually was translated with a scholarly by a scholarly translator whose name was Michael Doles, who's a great scholar of the plague Black Death in the Middle East. And he translated this, and he did this kind of a word-for-word translation where he translated a kind of he gave what he did was he used English pronouns. He used the neutered pronoun to refer to the plague, which is what we do. We don't call plague, we don't gender plague in English. We say it's an it. And the same thing he did with cities. So when the plague would, the cities, we don't gender. We say, we don't say, maybe old-fashioned times we used to gender cities, but not anymore. So this is what the kind of scholarly translation did as well. And when we were translating this, looking at the original Arabic, you see actually it really is the plague is gendered with the pronoun he, so and the cities are gendered with the pronoun she. And once you kind of bring back that element of this kind of plague marching around the Central Asia and the Middle East and wreaking havoc on all of these cities, you start to see kind of how, the plague is really this is this character. And you see this really rich, almost this very complicated this kind of a certain complicated kind of this almost this kind of of very gendered violence that's being described between this really this plague who's this this represented kind of representing this kind of unchained desire. So it's a fascinating text, a very nuanced text, and one that we spent months and months working on, even though it was a very small section of the book. So I won't read you the entire poem, but I'll read you some sections of it. The plague struck. Fear and death followed. For 15 years, he roved, then lingered in China, in India, and Sindh, far past the Oxus, in the land of the Uzbeks. For 15 years, all were ensnared by his dreaded hand. None were spared. In every stronghold, he found weakness. Count them. How many perished in Persia, Rome, and Cyprus? How many vanished from Crimea to the land of the Khitans? In Cairo, he crept upon every creature on whom he cast his eye, for they are on this earth. In Alexandria, he stilled her draw looms. At her Dar at-Tiraz, he spun like a slinking silkworm, her spinner's fate. Alexandria, city of pestilence, a beast roars, patience, even when only 7 of every 70 remain. In Ma'arat an-Nu'man, he soothed. Hush, hush, Hama's hurt has quenched my thirst. He beheld the village of Ma'ara as a heavenly nymph, her coal-black eyes alluring. But her brow was battered by abuse. What can a plague do to a place that tyranny thrust to the ground? He marched upon Sarmin and Fu'a, and rattled Sunni and Shia. He offered Antioch an ample share before retreating, whirling, as a man lost in flashes of his beloved in the campfire embers. He cooed to Shazar and Al-Harim, "Calm, you were in ashes before I came, and in ashes you will be after I go. Calm, calm, in time, these ruins will be rebuilt. Aleppo, land of suffering, the pestilence has become a vicious serpent. She kills your people with her venomous spit. By God, her evil is enough. If you could have seen the elites of Aleppo poring over arcane books of medicine, where numerous remedies abounded. They ate dried foods and citrus, slathered themselves with Armenian mud, brought their humors into balance, scented their homes with ambergris, camphor, sedge, and sandalwood, adorned themselves with ruby rings, and dined on onions, vinegar, and sardines. In place of nourishing broth and honeyed fruits was citron, citron, citron. If you had seen Aleppo, the caskets crawling across every corner, if you had heard the sobs and howls, you would have fled, abandoning your homes. The undertaker's wages rose, their labor's sweat was sweet, but they played and preyed upon their customers like hustlers, even as they turned most of them away. May their sweat turn sour. May they go unrewarded. The swindlers and the cheats have turned silver gray Aleppo pitch black in my eyes. The coffin makers have begun to dig their own graves.
Oh, I'm doing my podcast right now. I'm sorry.
Sorry. BBC podcast moment right there.
I'll edit that this morning. That was really dramatic. It's
It keeps going. I could also stop there because I read so much of it.
Interesting. Even the word Gaza is mentioned in the poem. The city of Gaza is mentioned in the poem as well.
Yeah, I know. And the ruin, you know, it's sad, you know, I mean, to read today. And it makes you think about destruction and rebuilding. But of course, it's this like very toxic, just this dark love. I mean, this very, very perverse kind of love between the plague and these cities. It's a very powerful work, and it's one that, we also formatted in a very interesting way. For those of you who pick up the printed copy, you see this kind of poem slithering like a serpent.
Yeah, yeah.
On the page, which
kind of a pictorial depiction of the theme. Yeah.
Yeah. And the serpent, of course, like being symbolic of the plague and part of the choice for the cover of the book as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a very rich poem. I also will say, you know, to anyone who is still listening to this podcast and hasn't turned it off already, there's an incredible reading of this poem by an actor who recorded this book for an Iraqi actor, recorded this book, the audiobook version. And he does an absolutely beautiful reading, a very surprising reading. And I think, you know, what was most meaningful when I listened to him reciting this poem was just the kind of, there's the poem has these very dramatic parts, but then it has these what I would when you know we were working on them, we kind of consider them the boring parts where you just kind of fall back on praise, you know, asking God for help, and it gets much more formulaic, you know, in those moments. You're just reciting these formula, when this actor recited this poem, he was almost deadpan in the dramatic parts. And then when he recited these formulaic, what I consider kind of more formulaic parts, they were real prayers. I mean, you honestly could hear him praying to God in those moments. And I think that opened up new, for me, it opened up new ways of hearing this text, and seeing kind of what this text might have meant, to audiences who were hearing it in the 14th and 15th centuries.
Miraj Sayed and Joel Blacker, I really hate to end this podcast. I could go on, but I understand it's too late now in Germany. Thank you very, very much for talking to us about your wonderful book, Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani's book called Merits of the Plague, published by Penguin Classics. Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts on New Books Network with us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah, that was great.